Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 1.6 of the Russian Empire History Podcast. I'm your host, JP Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire. Episode 6, Rediscovering the Scythians. In 1697, the young Tsar Peter the Great set out on his grand embassy to Europe. In Amsterdam, he met a man called Jacob de Wilde, the owner of an extensive collection of scientific instruments, antiquities, coins and medals, which Peter likely went on to acquire. The meeting stimulated the ever-curious Peter's interests, and he went out of his way to visit other collections on his tour through Holland and England, and began building his own collection of art, artifacts, items from Eastern cultures, and preserved malformed bodies and body parts, which particularly fascinated him. After his death, the collection would be displayed in the Kunstkamera on the banks of the Neva in St. Petersburg, before being moved to the Winter Palace and then on to the Hermitage. Among the items in the collection was a set of mostly gold artifacts from Siberia, which he gave to the Imperial Academy of Sciences that he founded, and which is now on display in the Hermitage as the Siberian Collection of Peter the Great. A Dutch diplomat and future mayor of Amsterdam, by the name of Nicolaas Witsen, arranged for Peter to work in the Dutch East India Company's Amsterdam shipyards and introduced him to scientists and collectors in the city. Witsen had spent 6 years in Russia and begun building a collection of Siberian artifacts, continuing to gather items through a network of Russian agents after his return to the Netherlands. In a letter, he wrote, quote, "How civilized must have been the people who buried these rarities. The gold objects are so artfully and sensibly ornamented that I do not think European craftsmen could have managed better." End quote. Peter became a keen collector of Siberian gold artifacts, tasking the governor of Siberia, Prince Matvey Gagarin, with the search. Gagarin sent Peter hundreds of items before he was hanged for abuse of authority in a completely unrelated incident, and other regional leaders and mine owners sent more. Peter was fascinated by the Siberian gold, not only because many of the artifacts are incredibly beautiful and he was always insatiably curious, but because they were also stimulating material for his aim to create a history of Russia and its peoples, which was still in many aspects a matter of legend at the time. The artifacts provided important insight and needed to be protected against being melted down or sold off abroad. So in 1718, he issued a decree ordering no more grave plundering. The penalty for anyone found digging for gold, stirrups and cups would be death. Instead, local officials were ordered to collect any inscriptions, ancient weapons, dishes, and, quote, anything old and unusual, to create catalogues of drawings of their finds and send them on to St. Petersburg. It was a pretty groundbreaking approach for the time, but it has always been difficult to enforce the king's writ from a distance, and Russia has bigger distances than anywhere else. Peter knew he needed to take a different tack. In 1716, he was visiting the German natural scientist and collector, Johann Philipp Breiner, in Danzig, now Gdansk, Poland. Breiner recommended the Tsar take on a German doctor, Daniel Gottlieb Messerschmidt, who helped build Breiner's collection, to lead an expedition to Siberia. Messerschmidt travelled to St. Petersburg and was charged with leading an expedition to Siberia to study its geography, natural history, medicine, medicinal herbs, diseases, peoples, languages, monuments, and antiquities. The expedition was to make a description of everything worthy of notice and to collect rarities and medical plants. In March 1719, he set out on a seven-year expedition. By the time he returned, Peter was dead. In his report on the expedition, he provided an expansive description of his brief. Quote, "I shall look for herbs and flowers, roots, birds and such like, and also for ancient burial objects, portrayals of people and animals, Calmuc mirrors. I was ordered to announce in the towns that everyone must bring me such herbs, roots, flowers, and ancient burial things, and if any of them are found worthy, the burial objects shall be paid for generously." End quote. As it turned out, almost no one brought him any gold, as any grave within reach had already been robbed long ago. However, as an Enlightenment scientist, he was not going to just assume there was nothing left, and he decided to excavate a few mounds himself. Although he was not impressed with his findings, this was the first excavation to take place in Russia for a scientific purpose, and thus the beginning of modern archaeology. Sadly, with Peter dead, the Imperial Academy of Sciences had moved on to other subjects. No more resources were made available to Messerschmitt, and just 2 years after his return from Siberia, he died in poverty at only 50 years of age. A couple of generations later, another great, Catherine, was on the throne, and Russia was advancing south to establish control over the Pontic-Caspian steppe, pushing out the Ottoman Empire. This brought new Kurgan-rich areas under its control, and people were ready to go looking for gold. General Alexei Melgunov, governor of Novorossiysk, ordered the excavation of several Kurgans near Litoy, which turned out to be rich burials from the 6th century BCE. One of the finds was a short iron sword, called an Akinakes, which is now recognized as a typical Scythian weapon, but was thought to be Sasanian at the time because the Persians had adopted the style. The sword was in a gold scabbard, decorated with fantastic stylized animals. The finds were displayed in the Kunstkamera, and it was not long before people started noticing how similar the designs of the Pontic steppe finds were to the Siberian gold. But the Pontic Kurgans were much more impressive than the Siberian ones. One documented in 1781 at Chortumlik was 20 meters high, that's 65 feet, and 50 meters or 165 feet in diameter. A buzz began building around the Scythians, and Herodotus' histories were translated into Russian for the first time. Catherine commissioned a German natural scientist called Peter Pallas, a professor at the St. Petersburg Academy of Sciences, who had already led one expedition east of the Urals to collect specimens, to explore the Pontic-Caspian steppe in 1793-1794. His findings, published as Travels Through the Southern Province of the Russian Empire in 1802, included the remains of Olbia, the Greek colony at the Bug estuary, which further boosted interest in the Greeks and Scythians. Museums were founded at Nikolaev, Feodosia, Odessa, and Kerch in the early 1800s, and became the driving forces behind excavations and collections. And in 1830, a team from the Kerch Museum started work on a Kurgan just outside the town. The Kurgan, known locally as Kul Orba, Crimean Tatar for Hill of Ash, would turn out to be the first Scythian royal grave excavated and gave birth to Scythian studies. The Kurgan, which was dated to the 4th century BCE, contained a stone tomb probably built by Greek craftsmen from the nearby Pantikapeum. The tomb was designed to imitate the form of a tent, with the body of the king placed on a wooden couch along the eastern wall. The king wore a crown, a gold pendant weighing almost 500 grams, over a pound, and several gold bracelets on each arm, and he was accompanied by a whip, a knife, and a quiver inlaid with gold and precious stones. To his left was a cypress and ivory sarcophagus containing a woman believed to be a wife or a concubine, in a brocade dress with an electrum diadem and heavy gold jewelry. Remains found at the south wall are believed to be a charioteer. Horsebones, armor, and spearheads were placed in a niche on the wall. Most interesting were the various vessels recovered from the tomb, which showed scenes of Scythian life, long-haired bearded Scythians in trousers and fur coats with pointed hoods, warriors with spears and shields, others carrying bows and arrows. One depicts a man stringing a bow. Another shows injured warriors receiving treatment for their wounds. These images were the first depictions of the Scythians seen since ancient times and brought Greek descriptions vividly to life. A large gold piece, probably a shield decoration, showed a stag lying with its legs tucked beneath it and its antlers stretching out above its back. The archaeologists immediately recognized it as similar to finds from Siberia. The Kul Orba finds were put on display at the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, enrapturing the public and impressing the imperial court enough for it to put up funding to continue the works. Visitors to the exhibition who had seen the Siberian finds looked at the reclining stag and began asking what the relationship was between the Pontic Scythians living next door to Black Sea Greeks and people thousands of kilometers away in the Siberian steppe. Excavations were launched at Kurgans all over the Caspian Pontic steppe. Most of the ones in what is now Ukraine turned out to have been stripped bare centuries ago. But further east, towards the North Caucasus, the finds started to build up. A gold-hilted iron sword in a gold sheath decorated with griffins and showing the Greeks fighting Persians, and other gold finds that showed the Greek goldsmiths of the Bosporan Kingdom were doing plenty of work for the Scythian elite. Iranian and Egyptian items demonstrated that there was a network of exchange. The last excavation before the First World War and Revolution put an end to such luxuries for a while was at Solofa on the banks of the Dnieper and yielded a wealth of grave goods, including a fantastic gold cone showing a battle scene between a warrior on foot and two mounted fighters, one of whose horses has just been killed. The warriors are wearing Scythian clothes with Greek-style armor, as was the king buried in the Kurgan. But 80 years of excavations had already produced considerable results and attracted attention from scholars around the world, especially because of the spectacular animal art, so different from classical images, and the intriguing idea of nomadic steppe barbarians living side by side with civilized Greeks. From Cambridge, a young scholar named Ellis Minns travelled to Russia to spend 3 years studying its antiquities. On his return to Britain, he wrote Scythians and Greeks, published in 1913, the book that introduced the Scythians to the English-speaking world. The revolution drove a Russian archaeologist who had been working in southern Russia and Ukraine, Mikhail Rostovtsev, to flee first to Britain and then to the United States, where he ended up teaching ancient history at Yale. In 1922, he published Iranians and Greeks in South Russia, following it up 3 years later with Scythians in the Bosporus. And in 1923, the first journal of Scythian studies, Scythica, appeared in Prague with Rostovtsev's article, Central Asia, Russia, and the Animal Style, in the first volume. Scythian studies had really begun. But what about these Eastern Steppe artifacts that people were trying to link to the Scythians? As mentioned already in this episode, interest in Siberia and the East had been growing over a long period, and the state had organized scientific expeditions to explore and document what they could find there. The Russian Empire was growing, resources were being opened up, and curious and educated men were attracted to make their fortunes in the East. One such man was Pyotr Frolov, a mining engineer working in the Barnaul district in the Altai Mountains, a range in Central Asia where Russia, China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan converge. He began collecting cultural artifacts, building up a considerable haul of antiquities and geological samples, including numerous extremely well-preserved Siberian animal-style carvings he acquired from peasants who dug them out of kurgans. Another young man in Barnaul was a German by the name of Vasily Rudkov, who arrived in the city to work as a schoolteacher. He quickly picked up an interest in regional folklore, becoming an expert in Turkic languages and laying the foundations of a career that would include helping to establish the Russian Museum of Ethnography and becoming director of the Asiatic Museum in St. Petersburg. In 1865, having seen and heard enough stories at second hand, he decided it was time to carry out his own excavations, choosing two sites at a village called Katanda and a site on the Beryl River. Getting into his dig, he found that the ground beneath the stone mound of the kurgans was permafrost, a phenomenon that had not yet been named at the time and was not really understood. This was the reason for the remarkably well-preserved carvings that people had been bringing to the collectors. The frozen ground preserved the organic materials. Along with the body in the grave, he found fur clothes and Chinese silks, as well as more of the animal carvings, showing that there was a nomadic art style across a huge territory. It is 5,000 kilometers, over 3,000 miles, from Barnaul to Crimea. As in the west of the country, before any real progress could be made building on Rudkov's discoveries, World War I and the Revolution put an end to archaeological work until well into the 20s. An archaeologist named Sergei Rudenko was chosen by the Russian Museum in Leningrad to lead an archaeological survey of the High Altai. In 1927, the expedition found a frozen first century grave at a place called Sheba. The grave contained riding gear, gold appliques, cut bark symbols, and a very well-preserved body. 2 years later, a kurgan at Pazarik in eastern Altai was excavated by expedition member Mikhail Griznov. The Pazarik kurgan was amazingly well-preserved, and layers of logs around the burial chamber had kept out the robbers, leaving the bodies of the dead man and 10 mares in perfect condition inside. The team halted the work to try to figure out how to handle the delicate organic material once it was removed from the permafrost. While they were doing so, disaster struck. Rudenko and Griznov were swept up by Stalin's Great Terror. Rudenko was accused of wasting time and money on pointless expeditions, and spent 4 years in forced labor building the Belomore-Baltic Canal. Soon after, Griznov was one of the accused in the Russian National Party case, also known as the Slavists case, a completely fabricated case in which a number of prominent ethnographers and linguists were accused of fascist agitation, organizing Ukrainian nationalists, and tendentiously emphasizing the achievements of the pre-revolutionary system. Over 70 scholars received sentences in the case, which was part of a campaign to destroy academic independence and centralize control over scientists and scholars. Grusinov was sent into exile until the late 1930s. The victims were rehabilitated after Stalin's death. Both Rudenko and Grusinov would be among the lucky survivors and were able to return to their work later. Rudenko returned to Pazaryk in 1947 and spent 3 years excavating 7 kurgans in one of the all-time great archaeological finds. 5 bodies were found in a state of preservation that meant that their elaborate tattoos, the earliest known examples, could still clearly be seen. 1, a powerfully built warrior chief, was extensively tattooed with interlocking animals and imaginary beasts, including a donkey, a mountain goat, highly stylized deer with trailing antlers, and some kind of imaginary carnivore. He had a chest piece of 2 griffins, a being the Greeks associated with Scythians and steppe culture, and thought of as living far in the east, that is, around Altai. 1 leg has running rams, touching each other to form a chain. The other leg is not well preserved enough to fully distinguish the tattoos, although there is a monster crawling over his foot. A series of circles is inked along his spine. Another famous find is the Pazaryk carpet, regarded as the oldest surviving pile carpet in the world. The carpet was sealed from the elements in a solid block of ice, and exceptionally well preserved. These days, you can see it on display at the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. It has around 360,000 knots per square meter, higher than most modern carpets, and depicts elk, deer, and mounted warriors, along with geometrical designs. It is believed to have been manufactured in Armenia or Persia around 400 BCE, demonstrating once again the extent of ancient trade routes, as it is over 4,000 kilometers, 2,200 miles, from Altai to Armenia. One other find of interest was a bag of cannabis seed, a sensor filled with rocks, and the frame of an inhalation tent. Cannabis was widely used in the steppe for rituals and entertainment. The rocks were heated in the sensor inside a small tent, and then the cannabis was thrown onto them to generate smoke. Partakers would stick their heads through an opening in the tent to inhale the smoke. Herodotus reported the Scythian smoking, writing that the vapor was much more agreeable than Greek incense, and the Scythians were transported and howled with joy. Incidentally, this was the first mention of cannabis in history. And that was not it for Pazaryk. New finds were made for decades, and investigations are still continuing. In 1993, a rare find was made of a single woman in an elaborate ceremonial grave. Dubbed, of course, the Ice Maiden, she lay in a hollow larch trunk coffin in a wooden chamber in the company of 6 horses. The casket was decorated with carved deer and snow leopards, and it appears the grave was flooded and frozen solid shortly after the burial, once again preserving the contents to an incredible degree. The Ice Maiden's horses were in full harness and placed at the north of the chamber. Her coffin was big enough to include her accoutrement. She was 167 centimeters tall, or 5'6", and was wearing a large felt headdress decorated with golden swans and cats. Her tattoos featured creatures with horns and antlers that branched out into flowers. She was dressed in a yellow wild silk shirt, a red and white wool skirt, and white felt socks. Dishes in the grave were filled with coriander seed, which does not grow in Altai, and would have been traded in from Iran. Rudenko initially assigned the name of Pazaric culture to the Kurgans, which dated to the 4th to 3rd centuries BCE, but it is now clear that the stylized animal tattoos and other elements are part of a common Scythian culture from Altai to the Western Steppe. The book he wrote describing his discoveries brought considerable attention to ancient nomad cultures in the Soviet Union, and was also published in English in 1970 under the title The Frozen Tombs of Siberia, The Pazaric Burials of Iron Age Horsemen, bringing them to the attention of the world. After the Second World War, archaeologists also returned to their investigations in Ukraine and southern Russia. Happily, the Scythians liked to place their burial chambers off-center in the Kurgans, or have other rooms buried beneath the first level, which helped to thwart grave robbers. An expedition to the Chertomlik Kurgan in the 1980s determined that the mound had been built of turf cut from the steppe. Based on its current size, which might have been worn down a bit by weathering over the centuries, the archaeologists estimated that 75 hectares of grassland, that's 185 acres, would have to have been cut to build the Kurgan. The phenomenal amount of work, and therefore manpower, that that would have required, shows the power and influence of the king buried there. The results of these digs led to Soviet archaeologists defining the notion of the Scythian triad to tie together the finds into a common culture, despite them ranging across thousands of kilometers and hundreds of years. The triad comprises weapons, horses, and the stylized animal art. The stylized animals are found on stelae, jewelry, weapons, utensils, and tattoos, and include stags, cats, birds, bears, wolves, and mythical creatures, particularly griffins. The animals are represented in dynamic poses, with legs tucked and heads outstretched. The stags have trailing antlers in a looped style that is unique to the Scythians. Interestingly, many scholars think that the figures appear to be reindeer, which live in the taiga rather than the steppe. Large pieces were made to decorate shields and clothing. The animals most likely had totemic significance and may have been intended to give the bearer their speed, strength, and endurance. Another characteristic type of art is scenes with a tree to one side and Scythian men involved in various activities, hunting, treating each other's wounds, making bows. These appear to be the result of Greek craftsmen responding to their steppe customers and adapting Greek art to their requirements. The horse part of the triad included both sacrificed horses buried alongside warriors and kings, and the various accoutrements of riding. As we have already noted, as well as the horses themselves, bits and bridles came from the steppe, and so too, somewhat later, did saddles and stirrups. The weapons included most importantly bows and arrows, although bows are actually rarely found in graves. The swords called akinakes, a short sword for close combat on foot, which gradually grew longer, lances and javelins. I will be going into weapons and horse gear in detail in a couple of episodes' time when we go in depth on steppe warriors. But Pazaric was not the end of Scythian discoveries in the East. In the mid-1970s, Mikhail Gruznov, yes, the same Gruznov who investigated Pazaric 45 years earlier and survived the Red Terror, still out there excavating the permafrost in his 70s, working with Tuvan archaeologist Mongush Manayun, opened a new site at Arjan in the Sayan Mountains of the Republic of Tula, on the border with Mongolia. The Arjan Kurgans, date to the 7th and 8th centuries BCE, and although they had been partially robbed over the centuries, because the main burial chamber was off-center, it was missed by robbers going straight for the most obvious target. The Arjan II Kurgan was selected for excavation in 1998. Not a lot of hope was held initially, as local residents had been taking stone from the mound for their own buildings for years, and it showed signs of having been robbed. But that off-center burial had thrown everyone off the trail, and it turned out to be one of the most spectacular sites ever discovered. The grave pit, which was opened in 2001, was sunk 4 meters deep with double log walls, and inside a man and woman were buried, together with 9,300 items, 5,700 of them made of gold, adding up to more than 20 kilograms of the precious metal. The gold items made a catalogue of Scythian animal art, with panthers, lions, camels and deer, clearly displaying all of the elements characteristic of the artifacts found thousands of kilometers to the west. The couple were, of course, dubbed the king and queen, although she could have been a concubine. The grave chamber was lined with felt. The king wore a gold torque carved with animal designs, and his clothes were sewn with thousands of gold panther-shaped beads, forming motifs like wings on his back. The queen was rather more modestly attired, but still with gold badges, bracelets, and a dagger decorated with gold. 33 other people, including 5 children, and 14 stallions in full gold, bronze, and iron finery, were also buried there. Genetic testing of the stallions shows that they come from different herds, perhaps given as tribute from the king's followers. Overall, the Arjan Kurgans provided a wealth of clearly Scythian finds that were older than those found in the Pontic Caspian steppe. This was extremely interesting because, naturally, the question of the origin of the Scythians had been a fascinating mystery since the first treasures were discovered. Herodotus had related what he said was the Scythians' own version of their origin story, that they had been driven out of the east and migrated to the Black Sea area. But this had largely been written off as his own invention. The assertion was that tales of Far Eastern origins were just an example of the Greeks' view of steppe nomads as barbarian others, and they had no basis in fact. As more and more finds were made from the Black Sea to the Altai Mountains, it became ever clearer that the Scythians had, in fact, been in the east. The discoveries at Pazaryk and Arjan, dated centuries before their Western counterparts, finally provided sufficient evidence, both in terms of the artifacts found and by genetic analysis of the remains, to postulate with a reasonable degree of certainty that the original Scythian homeland was in the Altai Sayan mountain region. The layers of archaeological remains at Arjan also allow links to be traced back to the Andronova and Sintashta cultures. Subsequently, other groups migrating from further east had put them under pressure, and they had followed the steppe gradient westwards to the East European plain, just like they told Herodotus 2,500 years ago. In the next episode, we will be doing a deep dive into Herodotus on the Scythians. He wrote about them at some length, describing their lifestyles, wars, burial rituals, food preparation, tribal differences among the different Scythian peoples, and other things. As the Scythians were for centuries lost to time, apart from what Herodotus and some other classical writers related, after all, they had no writing of their own, left no cities, temples, or amphitheatres behind them, much of what he wrote was simply discounted as myth. In the modern age, Herodotus' critics have even pointed to his writings on the Scythians as evidence that he just made stuff up. However, the discoveries of recent decades, and the greater availability of and attention to Persian, Chinese, and Central Asian sources allow us to see that a lot of what he wrote was actually true. Before leaving today, I'd like to say a big thank you to listener EWW17033 in the United States. It was so very kind as to leave my first review on Apple Podcasts. Why am I the first review, they write. I listened to the first episode, and it is incredibly rich. I hope JP keeps producing, because I am invested. Thank you, EWW17033. I certainly intend to carry on. And for anyone else, if you're enjoying the show and can spare a few minutes to leave a review, it does make it easier for new listeners to discover us. As always, check out the socials for maps and pictures to go with the episodes at the Russian Empire History Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and share the show with your friends. You can reach me through Facebook or at hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join me next time.